I put them, though? Roger stared vaguely about the room, which strongly resembled the sacking of the library at Alexandria, just before the first torch was lit. He rubbed his forehead, trying to concentrate. After a week of spending 10-hour days thumbing the handwritten registers of British prisons and the letters, journals and diaries of their governors, searching for any official trace of Jamie Fraser, Roger was beginning to feel as though his eyes had been sandpapered. "It was blue," he said at last. "I distinctly remember it was blue. I got those from McAllister, the history lecturer at Trinity at Cambridge. And Trinity College uses those big envelopes in pale blue with the college's coat of arms on the front. Maybe Fiona's seen it. Fiona!" He stepped to the study door and called down the hall toward the kitchen. Despite the lateness of the hour, the light was still on, and the heartening scent of cocoa and freshly baked almond cake lingered in the air. Fiona would never abandon her post while there was the faintest possibility that someone in her vicinity might require nourishment.
"Oh, hi!"
Fiona's curly brown head poked out of the kitchen. "They'll be cocoa ready directly," she assured him. "I'm only waiting for the cake to be out of the oven." Roger smiled at her with deep affection. Fiona had not the slightest use herself for history. Never read anything beyond My Weekly Magazine. But she never questioned his activities, tranquilly dusting the heaps of books and papers daily without bothering about their contents. "Thanks, Fiona," he said. "I was only wondering, though. Have you seen a big blue envelope? A fat one, about so?" He measured with his hands. "It came in the Morning Post, but I've misplaced it."
"You left it in the upstairs bath," she said promptly. "There's that great thick book with the gold writing and the picture of the bonny prince on the front up there, and three letters you just opened, and there's the gas bill too, which you didn't want to be forgetting. It's due on the 14th of the month. I've put it all on top of the geezer so as to be out of the way."
A tiny sharp ding from the oven timer made her withdraw her head abruptly with a smothered exclamation. Roger turned and went up the stairs two at a time, smiling. Given other inclinations, Fiona's memory might have made her a scholar. As it was, she was no mean research assistant. So long as a particular document or book could be described on the basis of its appearance rather than its title or contents, Fiona was bound to know exactly where it was.
"Oh, it's nothing," she had assured Roger airily when he had tried to apologise earlier for the mess he was making of the house. "You'd think the Reverend was still alive with such a moil of paper strewn everywhere. It's just like old times, no?"
Coming down more slowly, with a blue envelope in his hands, he wondered what his late adoptive father might have thought of this present quest.
"In it up to the eyebrows, I shouldn't wonder," he murmured to himself.
He had a vivid memory of the Reverend, bald head gleaming under the old-fashioned bowl lamps that hung from the hall ceiling as he pottered from his study to the kitchen, where old Mrs. Graham, Fiona's grandmother, would have been manning the stove, supplying the old man's bodily needs during bouts of late-night scholarship, just as Fiona was now doing for him. It made one wonder, he thought, as he went into the study. In the old days, when a man's son usually followed his father's profession, was that only a matter of convenience, wanting to keep the business in the family? Or was there some sort of family predisposition for some kinds of work? Were some people actually born to be smiths, or merchants, or cooks, born to an inclination and an aptitude, as well as to the opportunity? Clearly it didn't apply to everyone. There were always the people who left their homes, went a-wandering, tried things hitherto unknown in their family circles. If that weren't so, probably there would be no inventors, no explorers. Still, there seemed to be a certain affinity for some careers in some families, even in these restless modern times of widespread education and easy travel. What he was really wondering about, he thought to himself, was Brianna. He watched Claire, her curly, gold-shot head bent over the desk, and found himself wondering how much Brianna would be like her, and how much like the shadowy Scott, warrior, farmer, courtier, laird, who had been her father. His thoughts were still running on such lines a quarter hour later, when Claire closed the last folder on her stack and sat back, sighing.
"Penny for your thoughts?" she asked, reaching for her drink.
"Not worth that much,"
Roger replied with a smile, coming out of his reverie.
"I was only wondering how people come to be what they are. How did you come to be a doctor, for instance?"
"How did I come to be a doctor?" Claire inhaled the steam from her cup of cocoa, decided it was too hot to drink, and set it back on the desk among the litter of books and journals and pencil-scribbled sheets of paper. She gave Roger a half-smile and rubbed her hands together, dispersing the warmth of the cup.
"How did you come to be a historian?"
"More or less honestly," he answered,
leaning back in the Reverend's chair and waving at the accumulation of papers and trivia all around them. He patted a small gilt travelling clock that sat on the desk, an elegant bit of 18th-century workmanship, with miniature chimes that struck the hour, the quarter, and the half.
"I grew up in the midst of it all. I was ferreting round the Highlands in search of artefacts with my father from the time I could read. I suppose it just seemed natural to keep doing it. But you?"
She nodded and stretched, easing her shoulders from the long hours of stooping over the desk. Brianna, unable to stay awake, had given up and gone to bed an hour before. But Claire and Roger had gone on with their search through the administrative records of British prisons.
"Well, it was something like that for me," she said. "It wasn't so much that I suddenly decided I must become a doctor. It was just that I suddenly realised one day that I'd been one for a long time. And then I wasn't, and I missed it."
She spread her hands out on the desk and flexed her fingers, long and supple, the nails buffed into neat, shiny ovals.
"There used to be an old song from the First World War," she said reflectively.
"I used to hear it sometimes when some of Uncle Lamb's old army friends would come round and stay up late and get drunk.
It went, 'How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Paris?'"
She sang the first line, then broke off with a wry smile.
"I'd seen Paris," she said softly.
She looked up from her hands, alert and present, but with the traces of memory in her eyes, fixed on Roger with the clarity of a second sight.
"And a lot of other things besides. Caen and Amiens, Preston and Falkirk, the Hôpital des Anges, and the so-called surgery at Lioch. I'd been a doctor in every way there is. I'd delivered babies, set bones, stitched wounds, treated fevers."
She trailed off and shrugged.
"There was a terrible lot I didn't know, of course. I knew how much I could learn, and that's why I went to medical school. But it didn't really make a difference, you know."
She dipped a finger into the whipped cream floating on her cocoa and licked it off.
"I have a diploma with an MD on it, but I was a doctor long before I set foot in medical school."
"It can't possibly have been as easy as you make it sound."
Roger blew on his own cocoa, studying Claire with open interest.
"There weren't many women in medicine then. There aren't that many women doctors now, come to that. And you had a family besides."
"No, I can't say it was easy at all."
Claire looked at him quizzically.
"I waited until Brianna was in school, of course, and we had enough money to afford someone to come in to cook and clean. But..."
She shrugged and smiled ironically. "I stopped sleeping for several years there. That helped a bit. And, oddly enough, Frank helped too." Roger tested his own cup and found it almost cool enough to drink. He held it between his hands, enjoying the heat of the thick white porcelain seeping into his palms.
"Early June it might be,
but the nights were cool enough to make the electric fire still a necessity.
Really? He said curiously. Only from the things you've said about him, I shouldn't have thought he'd have liked your wanting to go to medical school or be a doctor.
He didn't. Her lips pressed tight together. The motion told Roger more than words might, recalling arguments, conversations half finished and abandoned. An opposition of stubbornness and devious obstruction, rather than of open disapproval. What a remarkably expressive face she had, he thought, watching her. He wondered, quite suddenly, whether his own were as easily readable. The thought was so unsettling that he dipped his face into his mug, gulping the cocoa, although it was still a bit too hot. He emerged from the cup to find Claire watching him, slightly sardonic.
Why? He asked quickly, to distract her. What made him change his mind?
Bree, she said. And her face softened, as it always did, at the mention of her daughter. Bree was the only thing really important to Frank. I had, as I'd said, waited until Brianna began school before beginning medical school myself. But even so, there was a large gap between her hours and my own, which we filled haphazardly with a series of more or less competent housekeepers and babysitters. Some more, most of them less. My mind went back to the frightful day when I had gotten a call at the hospital telling me that Brianna was hurt. I had dashed out of the place, not pausing to change out of the green linen scrub suit I was wearing, and raced for home, ignoring all speed limits, to find a police car and an ambulance lighting the night with blood-red pulses, and a knot of interested neighbours clustered on the street outside. As we pieced the story together later, what had happened was that the latest temporary sitter, annoyed at my being late yet again, had simply put on her coat at quitting time and left, abandoning 7-year-old Brianna with instructions to wait for Mummy. This she had obediently done for an hour or so, but as it began to get dark, she had become frightened in the house alone and determined to go out and find me. Making her way across one of the busy streets near our house, she had been struck by a car turning into the street. She wasn't, thank God, hurt badly. The car had been moving slowly, and she'd only been shaken and bruised by the experience. Not nearly as shaken as I was, for that matter. Nor as bruised when I came into the living room to find her lying on the sofa, and she looked at me, tears welling afresh on her stained cheeks, and said, "Mummy, where were you? I couldn't find you." It had taken just about all my reserves of professional composure to comfort her, to check her over, retend her cuts and scrapes, thank her rescuers, who, to my fevered mind, all glared accusingly at me, and put her to bed with her teddy bear clutched securely in her arms. Then I sat down at the kitchen table and cried myself. Frank patted me awkwardly, murmuring, but then gave it up, and with more practicality went to make tea. "I've decided," I said, when he set the steaming cup in front of me. I spoke dully, my head feeling thick and clogged. "I'll resign. I'll do it tomorrow."
"Resign?" Frank's voice was sharp with astonishment. "From the school? What for?"
"I can't stand it any more."
I never took cream or sugar in my tea. Now I added both, stirring and watching the milky tendrils swirl through the cup.
"I can't stand leaving Bree and not knowing if she's well cared for, and knowing she isn't happy.
You know she doesn't really like any of the sitters we've tried." "I know that, yes."
He sat opposite me, stirring his own tea.
After a long moment, he said, "But I don't think you should resign."
It was the last thing I had expected.
I had thought he would greet my decision with relieved applause.
I stared at him in astonishment, then blew my nose yet again on the wadded tissue from my pocket. "You don't?"
"Oh, Claire!"
He spoke impatiently, but with a tinge of affection nonetheless.
You've known forever who you are. Do you realise at all how unusual it is to know that?
No.
I wiped my nose with the shredding tissue, dabbing carefully to keep it in one piece.
Frank leaned back in his chair, shaking his head as he looked at me.
No, I suppose not, he said.
He was quiet for a minute, looking down at his folded hands. They were long-fingered, narrow, smooth and hairless as a girl's. Elegant hands, made for casual gestures and the emphasis of speech. He stretched them out on the table and looked at them as though he'd never seen them before.
I haven't got that, he said quietly at last. I'm good, all right, at what I do. The teaching, the writing. Bloody splendid sometimes, in fact. And I like it a good bit. Enjoy what I do. But the thing is...
He hesitated, then looked at me straight on, hazel-eyed and earnest.
I could do something else and be as good, care as much or as little. I haven't got that absolute conviction that there's something in life I'm meant to do.
And you have.
Is that good?
The edges of my nostrils were sore and my eyes puffed from crying.
He laughed shortly. It's damned inconvenient, Claire. To you and me and Bree. All three. But, my God, I do envy you sometimes.
He reached out for my hand, and after a moment's hesitation, I let him have it.
To have that passion for anything.
A small twitch tugged the corner of his mouth.
Or any one. That's quite splendid, Claire, and quite terribly rare.
He squeezed my hand gently and let it go, turning to reach behind him for one of the books on the shelf beside the table. It was one of his references, Woodhill's Patriots, a series of profiles of the American founding fathers. He laid his hand on the cover of the book, gently, as though reluctant to disturb the rest of the sleeping lives interred there.
These were people like that, the ones who cared so terribly much, enough to risk everything. Enough to change and do things. Most people aren't like that, you know. It isn't that they don't care, but that they don't care so greatly.
He took my hand again, this time turning it over. One finger traced the lines that webbed my palm, tickling as it went.
Is it there, I wonder, he said, smiling a little. Are some people destined for a great fate, or to do great things? Or is it only that they're born somehow with that great passion? And if they find themselves in the right circumstances, then things happen. It's the sort of thing you wonder, studying history. But there's no way of telling, really. All we know is what they accomplished. But Claire...
His eyes held a definite note of warning as he tapped the cover of his book.
They paid for it, he said.
I know. I felt very remote now, as though I were watching us from a distance. I could see it quite clearly in my mind's eye. Frank, handsome, lean, and a little tired, going beautifully grey at the temples.
Me, grubby in my surgical scrubs, my hair coming down, the front of my shirt crumpled and stained with Brianna's tears.
We sat in silence for some time. My hand still resting in Frank's. I could see the mysterious lines and valleys, clear as a road map. But a road to what unknown destination?
I had had my palm read once, years before, by an old Scottish lady named Graham. Fiona's grandmother, in fact. The lines in your hand change as you change, she had said. It's no so much what you're born with as what you make of yourself.
And what had I made of myself? What was I making?
A mess, that was what. Neither a good mother, nor a good wife, nor a good doctor. A mess. Once I had thought I was whole, had seemed to be able to love a man, to bear a child, to heal the sick, and know that all these things were natural parts of me.
not the difficult, troubled fragments into which my life had now disintegrated. But that had been in the past. The man I had loved was Jamie. And for a time, I had been part of something greater than myself. I'll take Bree.
I was so deep in miserable thought that for a moment Frank's words didn't register, and I stared at him stupidly. What did you say?
I said, he repeated patiently, that I'll take Bree. She can come from her school to the university and play at my office until I'm ready to come home.
I rubbed my nose. I thought you didn't think it appropriate for staff to bring their children to work.
He had been quite critical of Mrs. Clancy, one of the secretaries, who had brought her grandson to work for a month when his mother was sick. He shrugged, looking uncomfortable.
Well, circumstances alter cases, and Brianna's not likely to be running up and down the hall shrieking and spilling ink like Bart Clancy.
I wouldn't bet my life on it, I said wryly.
But you'd do that?
A small feeling was growing in the pit of my clenched stomach, a cautious, unbelieving feeling of relief. I might not trust Frank to be faithful to me. I knew quite well he wasn't. But I did trust him unequivocally to care for Bree. Suddenly the worry was removed. I needn't hurry home from the hospital, filled with dread because I was late, hating the thought of finding Brianna crouched in her room sulking because she didn't like the current sitter. She loved Frank. I knew she would be ecstatic at the thought of going to his office every day.
Why?
I asked bluntly. It isn't that you're dead keen on my being a doctor. I know that.
No, he said thoughtfully. It isn't that. But I do think there isn't any way to stop you. Perhaps the best I can do is to help, so that there will be less damage to Brianna.
His features hardened slightly then, and he turned away.
So far as he ever felt he had a destiny, something he was really meant to do, he felt that Brianna was it, Claire said. She stirred her cocoa meditatively.
Why do you care, Roger? She asked him suddenly. Why are you asking me?
He took a moment to answer, slowly sipping his cocoa. It was rich and dark, made with new cream and a sprinkle of brown sugar. Fiona, always a realist, had taken one look at Brianna and given up her attempts to lure Roger into matrimony via his stomach. But Fiona was a cook the same way Claire was a doctor, born to skill and unable not to use it.
Because I'm a historian, I suppose, he answered finally.
He watched her over the rim of his cup.
I need to know what people really did and why they did it.
And you think I can tell you that? She glanced sharply at him.
Or that I know?
He nodded, sipping.
You know, better than most people. Most of a historian's sources haven't your...
He paused and gave her a grin.
Your unique perspective, shall we say.
There was a sudden lessening of tension. She laughed and picked up her own cup.
We shall say that, she agreed. The other thing, he went on, watching her closely, is that you're honest. I don't think you could lie, even if you wanted to.
She glanced at him sharply and gave a short, dry laugh. Everyone can lie, young Roger, given cause enough. Even me.
It's only that it's harder for those of us who live in glass faces. We have to think up our lies ahead of time.
She bent her head and shuffled through the papers before her, turning the pages over slowly, one by one.
They were lists of names, these sheets, lists of prisoners copied from the ledger books of British prisons.
The task was complicated by the fact that not all the prisons had been well run. Some governors kept no official lists of their inmates, or listed them haphazardly in their journals, in among the notations of daily expenditure and maintenance, making no great distinction between the death of a prisoner and the slaughter of two bullocks, salted for meat.
Roger thought Claire had abandoned the conversation, but a moment later she looked up again.
"You're quite right, though," she said. "I'm honest, from default more than anything. It isn't easy for me not to say what I'm thinking. I imagine you see it because you're the same way."
"Am I?"
Roger felt absurdly pleased, as though someone had given him an unexpected present. Claire nodded, a small smile on her lips as she watched him.
"Oh, yes. It's unmistakable, you know. There aren't many people like that who will tell you the truth about themselves and anything else right out.
I've only met 3 people like that, I think. 4 now," she said, her smile widening to warm him.
"There was Jamie, of course."
Her long fingers rested lightly on the stack of papers, almost caressing in their touch.
"Master Raymond, the apothecary I knew in Paris.
And a friend I met in medical school, Joe Abernathy. Now you, I think." She tilted her cup and swallowed the last of the rich brown liquid. She set it down and looked directly at Roger.
"Frank was right in a way, though. It isn't necessarily easier if you know what it is you're meant to do. But at least you don't waste time in questioning or doubting. If you're honest, well, that isn't necessarily easier either. Though I suppose if you're honest with yourself and know what you are, at least you're less likely to feel that you've wasted your life doing the wrong thing."
She set aside the stack of papers and drew up another, a set of folders with the characteristic logo of the British Museum on the covers.
"Jamie had that," she said softly, as though to herself. "He wasn't a man to turn away from anything he thought his job, dangerous or not. And I think he won't have felt himself wasted, no matter what happened to him."
She lapsed into silence then, absorbed in the spidery tracings of some long-dead writer, looking for the entry that might tell her what Jamie Fraser had done and been, and whether his life had been wasted in a prison cell or ended in a lonely dungeon. The clock on the desk struck midnight, its chime surprisingly deep and melodious for such a small instrument. The quarter hour struck, and then the half, punctuating the monotonous rustle of pages. Roger put down the sheaf of flimsy papers he had been thumbing through and yawned deeply, not troubling to cover his mouth.
"I'm so tired, I'm seeing double," he said. "Shall we go on with it in the morning?"
Claire didn't answer for a moment. She was looking into the glowing bars of the electric fire, a look of unutterable distance on her face. Roger repeated his question, and slowly she came back from wherever she was.
"No," she said.
She reached for another folder and smiled at Roger, the look of distance lingering in her eyes.
"You go on, Roger," she said. "I'll just look a little longer."
When I finally found it, I nearly flipped right past it. I hadn't been reading the names carefully, but only skimming the pages for the letter J. John, Joseph, Jacques, James. There were James Edward, James Allen, James Walter, ad infinitum. Then it was there, the writing small and precise across the page, James Mackenzie Fraser of Broch Tuorach. I put the page down carefully on the table, shut my eyes for a moment to clear them, then looked again. It was still there.
"Jamie," I said aloud.
My heart was beating heavily in my chest.
"Jamie," I said again, more quietly.
It was nearly 3 o'clock in the morning. Everyone was asleep, but the house, in the manner of old houses, was still awake around me, creaking and sighing, keeping me company. Strangely enough, I had no desire to leap up and wake Brianna or Roger to tell them the news. I wanted to keep it to myself for a bit, as though I were alone here in the lamp-lit room with Jamie himself. My finger traced the line of ink. The person who had written that line had seen Jamie,
perhaps had written this with Jamie standing in front of him. The date at the top of the page was May 16, 1753. It had been close to this time of year then. I could imagine how the air had been, chilly and fresh, with the rare spring sun across his shoulders, lighting sparks in his hair. How had he worn his hair then? Short or long? He had preferred to wear it long, plaited or tailed behind. I remembered the casual gesture with which he would lift the weight of it off his neck to cool himself in the heat of exercise. He wouldn't have worn his kilt. The wearing of all tartans had been outlawed after Culloden. Breeks, then, likely, and a linen shirt. I had made such sarks for him. I could feel the softness of the fabric in memory, the billowing length of the 3 full yards it took to make one, the long tails and full sleeves that let the Highland men drop their plaids and sleep or fight with a sark their only garment. I could imagine his shoulders broad beneath the rough woven cloth, his skin warm through it, hands touched with the chill of the Scottish spring. He had been imprisoned before. How would he have looked, facing an English prison clerk, knowing all too well what waited for him? Grim as hell, I thought, staring down that long, straight nose with his eyes a cold, dark blue, dark and forbidding as the waters of Loch Ness. I opened my own eyes, realizing only then that I was sitting on the edge of my chair, the folder of photocopied pages clasped tight to my chest, so caught up in my conjuration that I hadn't even paid attention to which prison these registers had come from. There were several large prisons that the English had used regularly in the 18th century, and a number of minor ones. I turned the folder over slowly. Would it be Berwick, near the border? The notorious Tollbooth of Edinburgh, or one of the southern prisons, Leeds Castle, or even the Tower of London. Ardsmuir, said the note card neatly stapled to the front of the folder. Ardsmuir? I said blankly. Where the hell is that? Chapter 8. Honours Prisoner. Ardsmuir, Scotland, February 15, 1755.
Ardsmuir is the carbuncle on God's bum, Colonel Harry Quarry said.
He raised his glass sardonically to the young man by the window.
I've been here a 12-month, and that's 11 months and 29 days too long. Give you joy of your new posting, my lord.
Major John William Grey turned from the window over the courtyard where he had been surveying his new domain.
It does appear a trifle incommodious, he agreed dryly, picking up his own glass. Does it rain all the time?
Of course. It's Scotland, and the backside of bloody Scotland at that.
Quarry took a deep pull at his whisky, coughed and exhaled noisily as he set down the empty glass.
The drink is the only compensation, he said, a trifle hoarsely. Call on the local booze merchants in your best uniform, and they'll make you a decent price. It's astoundingly cheap without the tariff. I've left you a note of the best stills.
He nodded toward the massive oaken desk at the side of the room, planted 4 square on its island of carpet, like a small fortress confronting the barren room. The illusion of fortifications was enhanced by the banners of regiment and nation that hung from the stone wall behind it.
The guard's roster is here, Quarry said, rising and groping in the top desk drawer.
He slapped a battered leather folder on the desk top and added another on top of that.
And the prisoner's roll. You have 196 at the moment. 200 is the usual count, give or take a few deaths from sickness, or the odd poacher taken up in the countryside.
200? Grey said. And how many in the guards' barracks?
82 by number. In use, about half that.
Quarry reached into the drawer again, and withdrew a brown glass bottle with a cork. He shook it, heard it slosh, and smiled sardonically.
The commander isn't the only one to find consolation in drink. Half the sots are usually incapable at roll call. I'll leave this for you, shall I? You'll need it.
He put the bottle back and pulled out the lower drawer.
Requisitions and copies here. The paperwork's the worst of the post. Not a great deal to do, really, if you've a decent clerk. You haven't, at the moment. I had a corporal who wrote a fairish hand, but he died 2 weeks ago. Train up another, and you'll have nothing to do save to hunt for grouse and the Frenchman's gold.
He laughed at his own joke. Rumours of the gold that Louis of France had supposedly sent to his cousin Charles Stuart were rife in this end of Scotland.
"The prisoners are not difficult," Grey asked. "I had understood them to be mostly Jacobite Highlanders." "They are, but they're docile enough."
Quarry paused, looking out of the window. A small line of ragged men was issuing from a door in the forbidding stone wall opposite.
"No heart in them after Culloden," he said matter-of-factly. "Butcher Billy saw to that. And we work 'em hard enough that they've no vigour left for troublemaking."
Grey nodded. Ardsmuir Fortress was undergoing renovation, rather ironically using the labour of the Scots incarcerated therein. He rose and came to join Quarry at the window.
"There's a work crew going out now, for peat cutting."
Quarry nodded at the group below. A dozen bearded men, ragged as scarecrows, formed an awkward line before a red-coated soldier who walked up and down inspecting them. Evidently satisfied, he shouted an order and jerked a hand toward the outer gate. The prisoner's crew was accompanied by six armed soldiers who fell in before and behind, muskets held in marching order, their smart appearance a marked contrast to the ragged Highlanders. The prisoners walked slowly, oblivious to the rain that soaked their rags. A mule-drawn wagon creaked behind, a bundle of peat knives gleaming dully in its bed. Quarry frowned, counting them.
"Some must be ill. A work crew is 18 men, 3 prisoners to a guard because of the knives. Though surprisingly few of them try to run," he added, turning away from the window. "Nowhere to go, I suppose."
He left the desk, kicking aside a large woven basket that sat on the hearth, filled with crude chunks of a rough, dark brown substance.
"Leave the window open, even when it's raining," he advised. "The peat smoke will choke you otherwise."
He took a deep breath in illustration and let it out explosively.
"God, I'll be glad to get back to London."
"Not much in the way of local society, I collect," Grey asked dryly.
Quarry laughed, his broad red face creasing in amusement at the notion.
"Society? My dear fellow, bar one or two passable blouserbellers down in the village, society will consist solely of conversation with your officers. There are 4 of them, one of whom is capable of speaking without the use of profanity. Your orderly and 1 prisoner."
"A prisoner?"
Grey looked up from the ledgers he had been perusing, 1 fair brow lifted in inquiry.
"Oh, yes."
Quarry was prowling the office restlessly, eager to be off. His carriage was waiting. He had stayed only to brief his replacement and make the formal handover of command. Now he paused, glancing at Grey. 1 corner of his mouth curled up, enjoying a secret joke.
"You've heard of Red Jamie Fraser, I expect."
Grey stiffened slightly, but kept his face as unmoved as possible.
"I should imagine most people have," he said coldly. "The man was notorious during the Rising."
Quarry had heard the story, damn him. All of it? Or only the first part? Quarry's mouth twitched slightly, but he merely nodded.
"Quite. Well, we have him. He's the only senior Jacobite officer here. The Highlander prisoners treat him as their chief. Consequently, if any matters arise involving the prisoners, and they will, I assure you, he acts as their spokesman."
Quarry was in his stockinged feet. Now he sat and tugged on long cavalry boots in preparation for the mud outside.
Seamus MacCann Yir Droy, they call him. Or just MacDoove. Speak Gaelic, do you?
Neither do I.
Grissom does, though. He says it means James, son of the Black One. Half the guards are afraid of him, those that fought with Cope at Prestonpans. Says he's the devil himself. Poor devil now.
Quarry gave a brief snort, forcing his foot into the boot. He stamped once to settle it, and stood up.
The prisoners obey him without question, but give orders without his putting his seal to them, and you might as well be talking to the stones in the courtyard. Ever had much to do with Scots? Oh, of course. You fought at Culloden with your brother's regiment, didn't you?
Quarry struck his brow at his pretended forgetfulness. Damn the man. He had heard it all.
You'll have an idea, then. Stubborn doesn't begin to describe it.
He flapped a hand in the air as though to dismiss an entire contingent of recalcitrant Scots.
Which means...
Quarry paused, enjoying it.
You'll need Fraser's goodwill, or at least his cooperation. I had him take supper with me once a week, to talk things over, and found it answered very well. You might try the same arrangement. I suppose I might.
Grey's tone was cool, but his hands were clenched tight at his sides.
When icicles grew in hell, he might take supper with James Fraser. "'He's an educated man,'
Quarry continued, eyes bright with malice fixed on Grey's face.
"'A great deal more interesting to talk to than the officers. "'Plays chess. "'You have a game now and then, do you not?' "'Now and then.'
"'The muscles of his abdomen were clenched so tightly that he had trouble drawing breath. "'Would this bullet-headed fool not stop talking and leave?'
"'Ah, well.' I'll leave you to it.
As though divining Grey's wish, Quarry settled his wig more firmly, then took his cloak from the hook by the door and swirled it rakishly about his shoulders. He turned toward the door, hat in hand, then turned back.
Oh, one thing. If you do dine with Fraser alone, don't turn your back on him.
The offensive jocularity had left Quarry's face. Grey scowled at him, but could see no evidence that the warning was meant as a joke.
"'I mean it,'
Quarry said, suddenly serious.
"'He's in irons, but it's easy to choke a man with the chain. "'And he's a very large fellow, Fraser.' "'I know.'
To his fury, Grey could feel the blood rising in his cheeks. To hide it, he swung about, letting the cold air from the half-open window play on his countenance.
"'Surely,' he said to the rain-slick grey stones below. "'If he is the intelligent man you say, he wouldn't be so foolish as to attack me in my own quarters, in the midst of the prison. What would be the purpose in it?'
Quarry didn't answer. After a moment, Grey turned around to find the other staring at him thoughtfully, all trace of humour gone from the broad, ruddy face.
"'There's intelligence,' Quarry said slowly. "'And then there are other things. "'But perhaps you're too young to have seen hate and despair at close range. "'There's been a deal of it in Scotland these last 10 years.'
"'He tilted his head, surveying the new commander of Ardsmuir "'from his vantage point of 15 years' seniority.' Major Grey was young, no more than 26, and with a fair complexioned face and girlish lashes that made him look still younger than his years. To compound the problem, he was an inch or two shorter than the average, and fine-boned as well. He drew himself up straight.
"'I am aware of such things, Colonel,' he said evenly.
Quarry was a younger son of good family, like himself, but still his superior in rank. He must keep his temper. Quarry's bright hazel gaze rested on him in speculation.
I dare say.
With a sudden motion, he clapped his hat on his head.
He touched his cheek, where the darker line of a scar sliced across the ruddy skin, a memento of the scandalous duel that had sent him into exile at Ardsmuir.
"God knows what you did to be sent here, Grey," he said, shaking his head. "But for your own sake, I hope you deserved it. Luck to you."
And with a swirl of blue cloak, he was gone.
"Better the devil you can than the devil you don't,"
Murdo Lindsay said, shaking his head lugubriously.
"Handsome Harry was nane so bad."
"No, he wasna then," agreed Kenny Leslie. "But ye'll have been here when he came, no? He was a deal better than that shite-faced bogle, aye?"
"Aye," said Murdo, looking blank. "What's your meaning, man?"
"So, if Handsome was better than Bogle," Leslie explained patiently, "then Handsome was the devil we didna ken, and Bogle the one that we did. But Handsome was better, in spite of that. So you're wrong, man."
"I am."
Murdo, hopelessly confused by this bit of reasoning, glowered at Leslie.
"No, I'm not."
"You are, then," Leslie said, losing patience. "You're always wrong, Murdo. Why do you argue when you're never in the right of it?"
"I'm no arguing,"
Murdo protested indignantly.
"You're taking exception to me, not t'other way about."
"Only because you're wrong, man," Leslie said. "If you were right, I'd have said not a word."
"I'm not wrong. At least I didn't think so,"
Murdo muttered, unable to recall precisely what he had said. He turned, appealing to the large figure seated in the corner.
"McDoo, was I wrong?"
The tall man stretched himself, the chain of his irons chiming faintly as he moved, and laughed.
"No, Murdo, you're no wrong. But we canna see if you're right yet a while. Not till we see what the new devil's like, aye?"
Seeing Leslie's brows draw down in preparation for further dispute, he raised his voice, speaking to the room at large.
"Has anyone seen the new governor yet? Johnson? McTavish?"
"I have,"
Hayes said, pushing gladly forward to warm his hands at the fire. There was only one hearth in the large cell, and room for no more than 6 men before it at a time. The other 40 were left in bitter chill, huddling together in small groups for warmth. Consequently, the agreement was that whoever had a tale to tell or a song to sing might have a place by the hearth for as long as he spoke. McDoo had said that this was a bard right, that when the bards came to the old castles they would be given a warm place and plenty to eat and drink, to the honour of the laird's hospitality. There was never food or drink to spare here, but the warm place was certain. Hayes relaxed, eyes closed, and a beatific smile on his face as he spread his hands to the warmth. Warned by restive movements to either side, though, he hastily opened his eyes and began to speak.
"I saw him when he came in from his carriage, and then again when I brought up a platter of sweeties from the kitchens, whilst he and Handsome Harry were nattering to another."
Hayes frowned in concentration.
"He's fair-haired, wi' long yellow locks tied up wi' blue ribbon, and big eyes, and long lashes too, like a lassie's."
Hayes leered at his listeners, batting his own stubby lashes in mock flirtation. Encouraged by the laughter, he went on to describe the new governor's clothes.
"Fine as a laird's,
his equipage and servant.
One of the sassenachs as talks like he's burnt his tongue."
And as much as had been overheard of the new man's speech.
"He talks sharp and quick, like he'll know what's what,"
Hayes said, shaking his head dubiously.
"But he's very young forby. He looks scarce more than a wean, though I'd reckon he's older than his looks."
"Aye, he's a pretty fellow, smaller than wee Angus,"
Baird chimed in with a jerk of the head at Angus Mackenzie, who looked down at himself in startlement. Angus had been 12 when he fought beside his father at Culloden. He had spent nearly half his life in Ardsmuir, and in consequence of the poor fare of prison, had never grown much bigger.
"Aye," Hayes agreed, "but he carries himself well,
shoulders square, and a ramrod up his arse."
This gave rise to a burst of laughter and ribald comment, and Hayes gave way to Ogilvy, who knew a long and scurrilous story about the Laird of Donnybristle and the Hogman's daughter. Hayes left the hearth without resentment and went, as was the custom, to sit beside McDo. McDo never took his place on the hearth, even when he told them the long stories from the books that he'd read, the adventures of Roderick Random, the history of Tom Jones, a foundling, or everyone's favourite, Robinson Crusoe. Claiming that he needed the room to accommodate his long legs, McDo sat always in his same spot in the corner, where everyone might hear him. But the men who left the fire would come, one by one, and sit down on the bench beside him to give him the warmth that lingered in their clothes.
"Shall you speak to the new governor tomorrow, do you think, McDo?"
Hayes asked him as he sat.
"I met Billy Malcolm coming in from the peat-cutting, and he shouted to me as the rats were grown uncommon bold in their cell just now. 6 men bitten this se'nnight as they slept, and 2 of them festering."
McDo shook his head and scratched at his chin. He had been allowed a razor before his weekly audiences with Harry Quarry, but it had been 5 days since the last of these, and his chin was thick with red stubble.
"I canna say, Gavin," he said. "Quarry did see as he'd tell the new fellow of our arrangement, but the new man might have his own ways, aye? If I'm called to see him, though, I shall be sure to say about the rats. Did Malcolm ask for Morrison to come and see to the festering, though?"
The prison had no doctor. Morrison, who had a touch for healing, was permitted by the guards to go from cell to cell to tend the sick or injured at McDo's request. Hayes shook his head.
"They hadn't a time to see more. They were marching past, aye." "Best I send Morrison," McDo decided. "He can ask Billy, is there aught else amiss there?"
There were 4 main cells where the prisoners were kept in large groups. Word passed among them by means of Morrison's visits and the mingling of men on the work crews that went out daily to haul stone or cut peats on the nearby moor. Morrison came at once when summoned, pocketing 4 of the carved rat skulls with which the prisoners improvised games of draughts. McDo groped under the bench where he sat, drawing out the cloth bag he carried when he went to the moor.
"Oh, not more than a damn thistles," Morrison protested, seeing McDo's grimace as he groped in the bag. "I canna make them eat those things. They all say, do I think them kine, or maybe pigs?"
McDo gingerly set down a fistful of wilted stalks and sucked his pricked fingers.
"They're stubborn as pigs, to be sure," he remarked. "It's only milk thistle. How often must I tell you, Morrison? Take the thistle heads off and mash the leaves and stems fine, and if they're too prickly to eat, spread on a bannock, then make a tea of them and have them drink it. I've yet to see pigs drink tea, tell them."
Morrison's lined face cracked in a grin. An elderly man, he knew well enough how to handle recalcitrant patients. He only liked to complain for the fun of it.
"Aye, well, I'll say, have they ever seen a toothless cow?"
he said, resigned, as he tucked the limp greens carefully into his own sack.
"But you'll be sure to bare your teeth at Joel McCulloch next time you see him. He's the worst of them for not believing as the greens do help with the scurvy." "Say as I'll bite him in the arse," McDo promised, with a flash of his excellent teeth, "if I hear he hasna eaten his thistles."
Morrison made the small amused noise that passed for a belly laugh with him, and went to gather up the bits of ointment and the few herbs he had for medicines.
This ends Disc 4. Voyager 5.
McDo relaxed for the moment, glancing about the room to be sure no trouble brewed. There were feuds at the moment. He'd settled Bobby Sinclair and Edwin Murray's trouble a week back, and while they were not friends, they were keeping their distance from one another. He closed his eyes. He was tired. He'd been hauling stone all day. Supper would be along in a few minutes. A tub of porridge and some bread to be shared out. A bit of brose, too, if they were lucky. And likely, most of the men would go to sleep soon after, leaving him a few minutes of peace and semi-privacy, when he need not listen to anyone or feel he must do anything. He had had no time as yet even to wonder about the new governor, important as the man would be to all their lives. Young, Hayes had said. That might be good or might be bad. Older men who had fought in the Rising were often prejudiced against Highlanders. Bogle, who had put him in irons, had fought with Cope. A scared young soldier, though, trying to keep abreast of an unfamiliar job, could be more rigid and tyrannical than the crustiest of old colonels. Aye, well, and nothing to be done but wait and see. He sighed and shifted his posture, incommoded for the 10,000th time by the manacles he wore. He shifted irritably, banging one wrist against the edge of the bench. He was large enough that the weight of the irons didn't trouble him over much, but they chafed badly with the work. Worse was the inability to spread his arms more than 18 inches apart. This gave him cramp and a clawed feeling deep in the muscle of chest and back that left him only when he slept.
"MacDhu," said a soft voice beside him, "a word in your ear, if I might."
He opened his eyes to see Ronnie Sutherland perched alongside, pointed face intent and fox-like in the faint glow from the fire.
"Aye, Ronnie, of course."
He pushed himself upright and put both his irons and the thought of the new governor firmly from his mind. "Dearest Mother," John Gray wrote later that night, "I am arrived safely at my new post and find it comfortable. Colonel Quarry, my predecessor, he is the Duke of Clarence's nephew, you recall, made me welcome and acquainted with my charge. I am provided with a most excellent servant, and while I am bound to find many things about Scotland strange at first, I am sure I will find the experience interesting. I was served an object for my supper, which the steward told me was called a haggis. Upon inquiry, this proved to be the interior organ of a sheep, filled with a mixture of ground oats and a quantity of undefinable cooked flesh. Though I am assured the inhabitants of Scotland esteem this dish a particular delicacy, I sent it to the kitchens and requested a plain boiled saddle of mutton in its place. Having thus made my first humble meal here, and being somewhat fatigued by the long journey, of whose details I shall inform you in a subsequent missive, I believe I shall now retire, leaving further descriptions of my surroundings, with which I am imperfectly acquainted at present, as it is dark, for a future communication." He paused, tapping the quill on the blotter. The point left small dots of ink, and he abstractedly drew lines connecting these, making the outlines of a jagged object. Dared he ask about George? Not a direct inquiry, that wouldn't do, but a reference to the family, asking whether his mother had happened to encounter Lady Everett lately, and might he ask to be remembered to her son. He sighed and drew another point on his object. No, his widowed mother was ignorant of the situation, but Lady Everett's husband moved in military circles. His brother's influence would keep the gossip to a minimum. But Lord Everett might catch a whiff of it nonetheless, and be quick enough to put two and two together. Let him drop an injudicious word to his wife about George, and the word pass on from Lady Everett to his mother. The Dowager Countess Melton was not a fool. She knew quite well that he was in disgrace. Promising young officers in the good graces of their superiors were not sent to the arse end of Scotland to oversee the renovation of small and unimportant prison fortresses. But his brother Harold had told her that the trouble was an unfortunate affair of the heart, implying sufficient indelicacy to stop her questioning him about it. She likely thought he had been caught with his colonel's wife, or keeping a whore in his quarters. An unfortunate affair of the heart. He smiled grimly, dipping his pen.